I have this memory of being a brand new baby intern at a university counseling center where I was seeing this young couple, a man and a woman, who had recently gotten into an argument. And they were telling me about it, and I, of course, don't remember all the specifics anymore, except for this one. The man said that his girlfriend had texted him to say she was walking from one class to another with a classmate when usually they'd meet up to walk together. And the reason she was walking with this classmate was because it was raining and the classmate had an umbrella. And then the man said this one detail. He said, "I figured she wasn't walking with a guy because usually only girls carry umbrellas." And he said it really quickly and it was mostly insignificant to the point he was trying to make, but it took me back because I carried an umbrella always, like just in case. I had one on me that day. And I'm embarrassed to admit this, but I was really distracted by that comment. Like, I think for the rest of the session, my mind was elsewhere. And I was almost obsessively thinking, did I just never realize that men don't carry umbrellas? How did I miss that? And it's silly, right? Because it doesn't matter, but it's where my mind went. And I'm saying this just because I probably, like just about everybody else, I had this idea so ingrained in my head about what I was supposed to do, or in this case not do, because of my gender, that I couldn't shake the thought of getting it wrong. And I know it's ridiculous. I even knew that at the time. I was telling myself, who cares? Stop obsessing. But there I was, doing it anyways. And of course, these messages are in the minds of our clients too, you know? Like, how could they not be? One of the people who focuses a lot on gender issues, men's issues specifically, is this young emerging social worker named Ethan Getchell. He cares a lot about the impact of mental health messaging on men specifically, and then how that intersects with things like generational views of mental health. He himself is a Gen Zer, and I think partially because of that, he has this really unique insight, and then these interesting ideas related to flipping the script for young men in a way that hopefully shifts their view of mental health services, chips away at the stigma. Ethan has a unique story about entering the field, which wasn't always his career ambition. It actually wasn't until just a few years ago, right as he was about to graduate with his undergraduate degree, that his career trajectory shifted. Here's some of his story.
Yeah, so my pivot from the business world to social work happened my senior year, but really, I have to go back to my junior year. That's when the cause for that really started. So my junior year, this was 2022. It was March, and I was at the gym, and I'm usually never on my phone, but I got multiple phone calls from my brother, and I answer it, and he told me that our youngest brother, Austin, had just killed himself. And I hardly knew about suicide. So when I got that news, it just struck me. And I remember just being disoriented, confused, disbelief. But I went home and went through the whole kind of chaos that ensued for the next couple of days. And then spent the next year grieving. And pretty unfocused grief too, went in waves. It was really messy. Eventually I got into therapy, but I was pretty apprehensive about that even. I'd never been in therapy before. But what I was learning was the silent suffering that men go through. Austin, this 16-year-old boy who just got his driver's license, had a brand new blue Camaro that his dad got him. He had a cat, Tai-Tai, that he had to feed and take care of and love every day. So he had freedom. He had responsibility. He had community. He had love. And it just highlights the silent suffering and the complexity of suicide. So then to go through my grieving process, what that taught me was how disenfranchised grief is for suicide. The difficulties to grieve as a man, the lack of kind of guidance on male role models on how to grieve, how to cry, how to be emotional. So to go on that journey for a year gave me a desire to want to help others because of really the lack of voices and role models in that space. So February, my senior year, I was talking to a mentor and I was telling him that I was really feeling disheartened about going into commercial real estate. I was like, I just don't have the same energy, same desire to go into it. And I think if he had told me, you know, suck it up and go into business, I would have. But he was very purpose-centered and passion-centered and said, what's your dream? Like, if you could do anything, what would you do? What's your crazy idea? And I said, I would love to go into mental health counseling and support young men who are struggling with depression, who are grieving. And then spent the next 16 months flipping 180 and learning a whole new world. There aren't more different worlds than business and social work.
Up next, Ethan will talk more about some of his beliefs about how we can create a new route for men to enter mental health treatment, one that's been influenced by his experiences on both sides of the coin.
I had always assumed that your interest in men's mental health was really driven by your brother. And it sounds like to some degree, it was maybe also driven by like your own experience with grief. Mm-hmm. Maybe you felt like there was a need kind of like more services in that way.
Yeah. When you tell people that your brother died by suicide, that's where their attention goes. And my own grief story sometimes takes a back seat, but I'm working on a project to talk about preventing suicide and understanding depression and grief, because those two pieces go hand in hand. And I think it's just as important to support those who are affected by grief as it is to support those who are struggling with depression and suicide.
Do you think it's a totally different treatment experience with men? Like, do you think treatment looks really different?
I think the vessels for attention are different. And what I mean by that is the traditional talk therapy, sitting face to face, is less effective for young men specifically than it is for women. I think women have a much easier time kind of sitting and talking and processing their emotions. I think guys are still lagging behind in that. But where they make up for it is in like an activity driven or car therapy, where you're sitting side by side. You're not looking at each other. You're doing something else. You're golfing, you're rock climbing, you're on a run. It's in those other activities that guys have an easier time opening up and being vulnerable. And you see that happen your day to day so naturally. And so for me, I'm like, why do we neglect this in the therapy space? Let's lean into this as not really in a modality, but as a vessel for their attention and vulnerability. So effective therapy is part of the problem. The other part of the problem that I'm really passionate about is breaking the stigma and getting them into the door. And that's where I pull in a lot of my business and marketing background, marketing and communication, understanding social media, understanding where young men's attention is, and how social workers, how clinicians can enter these spaces and be a voice and be inviting for young men. I think there are a lot of people who are very loud and understand the systems today really well, but have a subpar offer.
I guess, can you talk more specifically about that? Like, what if, I mean, how do you market the young?
I think at a fundamental level, you have to speak their language. One of the areas that we need to improve is how do we communicate and share a message that breaks the stigma that therapy is this lay on the couch and is something that is somehow feminine, that is associated with weakness, that's going to be painful, that's a waste of time. I feel like that is a lot of the language, that's a lot of the resistance, that's the stigma around mental health. You don't need therapy, you just need to make more money, and you just need to work out more, and you just need to make more friends. Well, if you have mental health issues, if you have these things that are in the way, it's going to be hard for you to stay focused at your job. It's going to be hard for you to make friends if you have social anxiety. It's going to be hard for you to understand your sense of identity if you're wrestling with grief and with these traumas. And so we have to understand the problem, and we have to communicate in a way and be in the spaces that young men are. And young men are in social media. They're on Instagram. They're on LinkedIn. They're on TikTok. And so we have to figure out how do we communicate our messages effectively so that we're reaching this audience and so we can impact them. Again, we have to kind of take a step back and look at who are the voices in the space. When you look at social work, it's dominated by women in the industry. I think in my graduating class, it was like 10% male. And I went to a continued education course on suicide prevention. And I think there was one other guy there out of like 30. And so the education and the passion for men in this industry, I think, is lagging and it isn't there. I think that's where there's an opportunity.
Yeah.
There's a great book of Boys and Men by Richard Reeves, and he's an economist and a policy researcher. And he does a great job of laying out the statistics. And one of the things he talks about is we have STEM industries and we have HEAL industries. HEAL being like health, education, arts, literature. That might be wrong, but you get the idea. Those are like the HEAL industries. And he one of the things that he says towards the end of the book, of one of his solutions, is like increasing men in HEAL industries, having more scholarships for men who want to become teachers, men who want to become social workers. So at a policy level, really broadly, and we can come back to kind of that clinical level, but at a broad level, if we want to make those changes at an individual level, then we have to have policy that promotes men in these industries and can give them a standard of living that makes it worth pursuing these passions. And what's interesting is you can look at trends in credibility and people believing in therapy over time. One of the first major shifts was World War II and men coming back from war, and just the surge of PTSD and mental health issues that were occurring, and people being like, this is legit. We need to spend more attention, more time, and more money helping these men. And you saw a huge trend increase in legitimacy in jobs and in the research behind the DSM. Like, you saw a lot of evolution at that time. What's interesting is you see a similar parallel coming out of COVID-19 and the pandemic. Coming out of the pandemic, the increase in depression, anxiety, loneliness skyrocketed. And now all of a sudden you have more men. Again, I'm focusing on men here that are saying, yeah, I'm struggling. And so there's an increasing demand for it. And there's an increasing legitimacy and receptiveness towards this message. So now in the recent years post COVID, you have people who are saying, you know, mental health care is legit. Like, we do need to take care of our mental health. There's an increasing loneliness. And it's laid out really well. Another good book is The Anxious Generation, and it talks about that trend with young men. And so we see, again, now I'm kind of going into details. This is kind of my jam here, but the largest group that's dying by suicide is elderly men. So they're the largest number, but the largest rate increase in the last 5-10 years is actually young men, like 14 to 18. To like 20. And that is a very alarming statistic. And what it's saying is that increasingly young men are feeling more lonely and isolated. That can be associated with pandemic. It's also with technology. socialization, male mentors. There's all kinds of factors behind that.
Why do you think those have impacted like men in a particularly significant way?
I would say men are tired of the previous coping strategies that have been presented to them from the older generation. A big thing that I've been learning about is covert depression and how men will externalize their loneliness. And for women, it shows up as sadness, tears. You can kind of tell that they're depressed or they're anxious or kind of those traditional diagnoses of depression, anxiety. For men, it's looked really different in the past. It's been more risk-taking. It's been gambling. It's been drinking. It's been workaholic and working hard. Things that you wouldn't initially view as negative things. And now today, I think you go through something extreme like the pandemic. Now these previous coping strategies aren't working. And in fact, there's so much not working that it's leading to these things like suicide, which is the most extreme version of loneliness and hopelessness. These men are saying, I don't have any other option. There's no hope for me. I can't be fixed. I'm too lonely. I'm too hopeless. And you pair that with a natural biological function of risk-taking, access to lethal means, guns, and it's creating this really devastating statistic today. There's some pretty interesting statistics. So along with the groups, the highest means of suicide is firearms. It's like 54% of suicides are conducted through lethal means, through firearms. And now you get into why is that? It gets a little bit more murky, but it has a lot to do with the natural risk-taking behavior of men. Men who are who like the adrenaline rush of sport, of football, of racing, and then you take this energy that can be positive, and then you associate it with loneliness, or you lose a friend, or you lose a relationship, and then you want to. Then that risk-taking behavior then becomes applied to firearms. Then you look at preventative measures. The number one preventative measure for preventing suicide is non-parental mentorship, which I thought was fascinating when I learned about this. And this is where there's a huge opportunity for clinicians. It doesn't just mean clinicians. It can mean uncles, aunts, grandparents, coaches, but it can also be clinicians. So stepping in, saying, look, there is a large trend of young men who are dying, are feeling lonely. One of the best ways to prevent that is by having mentors. I think there's a real opportunity for clinicians to step into that space and offer their services for this group. Yeah, so that's another thing that Richard Reeves kind of lays out in his book. He talks about men in HEAL industries, but he also talks about apprenticeships. And if you look globally at the countries that are offering apprenticeship, today the U.S. is one of the lowest. Previously, I think historically it's been higher because when you think apprenticeships, a lot of it is in like working class in the trades. There are a lot of mentorship opportunities in electrical, in concrete, in framing. A lot of these trades offer apprenticeships, and those are really important, and you can view those as that non-parental mentorship guide. So he offers that we need to push for these vocational trends. So we need men in HEAL, but we also need more men in the trade vocations because there's a piece there, that apprenticeship, that is really good for your mental health.
like even professions where that isn't currently built in, maybe it could be, you know, like from an educational standpoint as well, I think that'd be really beneficial.
Yeah. Yeah. It's trending away, which I don't really know the cause for, but it's really sad to see. I think any industry, there can be an opportunity for apprenticeship. And that's one of the things that I'm really grateful for in my undergrad experience was their emphasis on having mentors. And I had a great professor that I leaned on through my 4 years, older gentleman, and he would help me in school, but also in life. And we'd ask questions and I would go in his office and I would cry and had a great relationship. And so knowing that that was important for my life, going into my master's in social work, I was seeking out like male mentorship and I didn't find it in my master's program. So I still leaned on my undergrad and I had male mentors outside of school, but I couldn't find it in the school social work, which is interesting.
Was that the mentor who kind of talked with you about pursuing social work?
Yeah.
That's the one you're thinking about? See, that's so cool. So think about the impact that he had on your trajectory of your life.
Yeah. And yeah. It was the support of my family. And ideally, you would have really strong parents, but that is complemented with really good mentor. I think you need both. Yeah, I met this woman, Jody Frey. She is a researcher at the University of Maryland. And she was introduced to this idea. It's called Man Therapy. They have a website. It's based out of like Colorado or kind of out west, but it's kind of spreading into the Midwest, Michigan. And their model is, if you go on their website, there's this white guy sitting in a leather chair with a big old mustache, and he's kind of cracking jokes, and he like lifts up this, he's like, I'm gonna do some reading. It's good for our mental health, and it's like a manual for your lawnmower, and he's like pulling a fish out of his lunchbox and kind of leaning into these traditional ideas of masculinity, using it as a way to communicate and build rapport with these men who are struggling, especially older men who are struggling. And at first she's like, I just don't know about this humor. Like as a professional, she's like questioning the legitimacy of it. But then as she started doing the research and sending it out there and trying to get interest, she found that it's engaging more and more of these men as a way to get them in. And so I don't position myself as a leading expert in clinical practice. I have quite little clinical prep experience. But what I offer is kind of my marketing background and my passion for connecting. And one of the things that I have learned in my clinical experience is how important it is to build rapport with your clients and how important it is to connect and build trust and create a space for them to be vulnerable, because it's in that space and that vulnerability that the magic happens and the work is done. And so my interest is, how do we create that space for young men? And it's things like Man Therapy, who are using humor, who are understanding kind of the attention span and the difference between men and women that are going to have success in their practice. I think a strong piece of advice that applies to anybody is to avoid the thought of a one-size-fits-all model. I think it's important to recognize our strengths, our limitations, our biases. But when people step in, everyone has a unique experience. And unfortunately, I think men have been compartmentalized and we're trying to fit them into this model of therapy that isn't working for them. And so I think it requires a curiosity of, how do we engage them? What are the things that are working? And I don't believe it's a difference in modalities. I think CBT, DBT, like these modalities of therapy can be effective for men. It's more the communication and the application of these things. I think it needs to look different. So if you're used to having 30, 40 people that rotate in and out of your office, you've become comfortable with the system. It works really well for you as a clinician, but I would just ask you to think about, is it working well for your male patient?
Yeah, yeah. And you do have such this unique view of, we're not communicating a message. We're not branded well in a way that's working, particularly for young men. But I'm not sure for men in general, honestly. Yeah. Maybe this is a generational issue. It's just nobody's talked about something.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great point. And it's a lot of the recent conversations I've been having when I got involved in social work and in therapy. I felt like I was picking up an old book and just like blowing off the dust. I was like, how is this product, this offer going to be effective for Gen Z young men? And so my interest is like stepping into it. And as I talk to people about these things, it's a really big part. And so I do feel like I'm on the cusp of this new generation of therapy, this increase in telehealth, this increase in self-disclosure. Like, what does that look like with social media presence? Social media can be a real strength for reaching that young man that's isolated and struggling, who's on his phone all the time. If you're really loud and you have a strong influence in a large audience, you're going to reach that person. At the same time, you're now creating a certain level of self-disclosure. You're telling your story. I published a book after I graduated from undergrad, telling the story of how my brother died by suicide and my grieving process, and talking with my supervisor and talking in the school of social work, like, and asking them, like, we talk about self-disclosure, and the traditional form of therapy was, you really want to be kind of a chameleon. You want to be neutral. You want to create a space that isn't going to offend or hurt or kind of swayed the clients that you're seeing. That's fair. That's really important to understand. At the same time, I published this book and I'm like, how is this going to impact my future clientele? Can it be harmful? Can it turn away some people, certain groups? Yes. Will it help me reach more people ultimately and be a positive thing? I think so. So I believe there's going to be a trending change in the therapy space. It's going to require us to use the vessels that are attracting the eyeballs of the people that we want to be working with. I'm not necessarily trying to provide the right answer. I'm just trying to stimulate more conversations and more thoughts and pushback and questions. And ultimately, through all of that, we can craft something that's going to be effective for these young men that are struggling, and that we can combat these significant statistics in suicide rates and loneliness, because it's something that more and more increasingly we're seeing that we can't avoid.
Beyond thinking outside of the box about how to address the stigma men might face in seeking treatment, it's also important to think about how other cultural considerations come into play. So men from different backgrounds, for example, they might face different pressures around masculinity and emotional expression. You should consider the intersection of mental health with sexual orientation as well. Men who are LGBTQ+ might experience additional stressors like discrimination or internalized stigma, which can, of course, impact their mental health. Like Ethan mentioned, there's no one prototype for how men show up in therapy. It's what makes our jobs challenging, but also so interesting. And keep in mind that there are so many aspects of being a good clinician that have somewhere between little to absolutely nothing to do with the gender identity of the client in front of us. Things like creating a non-judgmental space and being patient and empathetic. And then, of course, just understanding and supporting the unique experiences of everyone. Things that are probably already part of the work you're doing without even thinking about them. So yes, there is opportunity to think differently about how to support men in therapy through micro and macro approaches. And I hope you consider them because I think they're important. But also, just keep doing what you're doing, just with a thoughtful plan, man.